From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina, not Kansas, should serve as the national model for state-level tax reform. You'll hear why a key staffer at the group Americans for Tax Reform makes that argument in his trips across the country. Members of North Carolina's congressional delegation continue to make news. You'll learn why the newest member of that delegation is supporting bills to scrap the so-called Davis-Bacon Act and to step up the fight against financial aid for terrorists. You'll also hear from the head of the influential House Freedom Caucus. What's that group all about, and why is he leading it? Plus, we'll discuss a decrease in the latest North Carolina public school enrollment numbers. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
When CEOs choose to publicly engage in political debates, can their shareholders take them to court if that CEO's action hurt the value of the stock? Well, that is a key question addressed in a Wall Street Journal piece co-authored by the John Locke Foundation's Senior Vice President, John Pritchett. John joins us now to talk about this interesting subject. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, congratulations. You co-authored this with Ed Teriakin, who is a Duke University economics professor. Quite an honor to be published in the Wall Street Journal, first of all.
You can check it off my bucket list. I've been reading it for 33 years.
Nice to see your own name there, too. Yeah. Why in the world did you decide to start writing about this issue of politics and shareholder value?
Well, I like to look at liberty and freedom and free markets through the lens of my experience, like anyone else. And a lot of my experience has been in business, and I'm also an investor. And so shareholder value is an important part of business. And at the same time, I'm also very interested in sort of the culture warfare that's going on. And so Ed and I have been talking about this subject. In our view, it's sort of akin to some of the other things that we've talked about and written about, like, for example, how the left is trying to use sports as a weapon and sort of a CEO social activism is along the same lines. So it just so happens that we've been working on this story for a little while. And then last week when we had all the resignations from the White House Council on Manufacturing, we said, you know what, that's a pretty good time for us to tighten up the story and submit it to the journal. And they agreed.
In your piece, you make an interesting point about one of the CEOs in particular who resigned from that business council. Those councils, by the way, President Trump has shut down. But this CEO had an opportunity to be face-to-face with the President of the United States, and one would think that that would be something valuable for that organization, even if that CEO disagreed completely with the President, either what he said or didn't say about Charlottesville or any other policy. One would think a CEO would want to keep that seat?
Yeah, so that's particularly agitating for me. You know, if you think about The Godfather, it's not personal, it's business. When you're the CEO of a publicly traded company, and to be clear and make the distinction, difference between a CEO of a private company and the CEO of a publicly traded company, there is a fiduciary responsibility. There's something called shareholder primacy, where your job as the CEO, and you're paid well for it, is to take care of long-term shareholder value, is to increase market share, is to create profits. That is your job. And by the way, that's a really good, big job, an important job, because when we think about it, that's how the market works. And so, you know, that should be enough, sort of full stop, right, period. You have the opportunity to create opportunity for employment and jobs and wealth creation, and then people can decide what they want to do with that wealth creation. When all of a sudden it becomes a personal issue, and you see people resign from, in this case, you're talking about Ken Frazier at Merck, who is the head of one of the largest companies in the pharma industry. He is sitting amongst the leaders of the government who regulate an industry. An industry, by the way, which has been, in my view, overly regulated and is in need of some sort of serious regulatory reform, which could be helpful to the business, which can be helpful to the economy, which can be helpful to all of us. And to resign from that opportunity to be setting the agenda, to be with policymakers and with the door closed, having these sorts of conversations that we all know and many times is how you are able to get your ideas across to those who regulate industry. It seems to me if you had a personal problem with that, either one, put on your big boy pants and get over that issue because you're doing something greater than representing yourself. You're representing your company, therefore your shareholders. And to make it personal, you know, perhaps it's a personal conviction, and the CEO in this case, maybe Ken Frazier, felt so it was so important for him that he could not be in these meetings, then my suggestion would be, okay, have your CFO go, have your COO go, have your general counsel go. You want the company, Pfizer, in the middle of this regulatory debate. He took the company out of it. And in my view, that's such an overreaction to this media hysteria. And so, again, back to the Godfather, right? It's business. It's not personal.
What is a shareholder to do if they take a look at their investment and say, hey, wait a second, this activist CEO made this public decision, and it appears that the stock price is falling because of that? Do you have recourse?
So Ed Teriakin and I looked at this issue, and we said, what does history say about recourse for shareholders? And there's a lot of legal history. One of the landmark cases we referenced in the article, 1919 case, which was Dodge v. Ford. Henry Ford had created a very valuable company and was generating lots of money and decided at a certain point that rather than dividends to his shareholders, he was going to give money away for good causes. As you might imagine, some of the shareholders had a different idea about that.
Admirable.
And As it might be.
But they're shareholders.
They were saying, basically, let us decide if we want to give away the money as shareholders, right? That shouldn't be your personal decision. And the courts upheld that. Now, what a lot of legal scholars will say, and they're correct, is that there is a business judgment rule. There is latitude. And even in that case, there was latitude given to a chief executive about the rationale of making decisions. But that is not to say it's without limits. You still have this primacy of shareholder. You still have this process that you go through when you get information, you deliberate, is this in the best long-term interest of the company and the shareholders? And that's where we suggest when shareholders, when boards won't hold CEOs accountable for this sort of CEO social activism, then there is the ability to go to court. And it's not as difficult as one might think. Particularly if you're a small shareholder. Lots of people will say, well, all of these companies have institutional shareholders, and those are big companies. But they're made up of small retiree teachers and other folks who have pension and retirement programs where they may own several shares of that stock, and therefore they have standing to sue. And in our view, when we can't get an answer to something through the governance, a corporate governance, and we have to turn to the courts.
Some of those people you mentioned may not even realize all the different stocks that they own through mutual funds and things like that. Just average folks who are invested a little bit in the market for retirement, and this could be happening and they wouldn't know. In our final minutes with you, John, I'd like to talk to you briefly about the situation with Target, which you reference in the Wall Street Journal piece. We know in North Carolina we went through the situation with House Bill 2. Target CEO strongly opposed House Bill 2, which has since been repealed, but he came out with what he termed an inclusive bathroom policy. Tell us what happened after that.
Yeah, so in our view, again, this is a social activism piece that from a shareholder standpoint you get upset about because you realize that, and you're talking about Brian Cornell, when he made the decision to issue this this program, he really obviously didn't consider this is the business rationale process that we were talking about. I didn't really consider the implications of customers, for example. and made the decision because he felt, for whatever reason, that this was something he was interested in. My view is he'd be better off doing that with his own personal money if that's what his interest is, and not necessarily Target, because, as you know, a lot of the customers of Target decided to boycott, and as a result, we saw a $20 billion drop in market cap.
John Pritchett, who is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation, he co-wrote this with Ed Teriakin, who is at Duke University. And you can read this piece at johnlocke.org and also, of course, at the Wall Street Journal's website. John Pritchett, thank you very much.
Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Critics of conservative tax reforms like to point to Kansas. They say that state's recent budget struggles prove that tax cuts create too many problems. But our next guest offers an alternative view. Patrick Gleason is Director of State Affairs at Americans for Tax Reform. His recent column for Forbes has the headline, "Forget Kansas, North Carolina is the national model for conservative tax reform." Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Mitch.
So you took a look at tax reform. As part of your job, you take a look at the effect of tax reform and tax burdens across the country. Mm-hmm. You say Kansas isn't really the model. North Carolina is the model. Why is that?
Yeah, so you've seen a lot of national media coverage about Kansas in recent years and in recent months particularly about what they've done on taxes and tax reform and what's been happening with their budget. And a lot of the focus has been on how Kansas has had budget deficits following the tax cuts passed in 2012. And there is a concerted strategy on the part of the National Democratic Party and left of center pundits and folks in the media to hold up Kansas as what they claim is the model of conservative tax relief, tax reform, and that, and then they say, they claim that this has led to the budget disaster or challenges that Kansas has faced. Well, that couldn't be farther from the truth for a number of reasons based on what has happened in Kansas. But I point to North Carolina as actually the model for what conservative, limited government, free market oriented tax reform looks like. So there's a lot of focus on Kansas, but actually North Carolina, both in terms of population and the economy, is three times the size of Kansas. Much more economically and politically important state. But it has gotten, although it's three times the size of Kansas, it's gotten a fraction of the attention. And that's unfortunate because it really deserves, frankly, more attention than Kansas and certainly more than it's been getting. And what I point out is where Kansas made mistakes and went wrong and made bad decisions, North Carolina went the other way and made the right decision. So going back to 2012, Kansas cut taxes. Well, at the same time they cut taxes, they failed to rein in spending. When you're cutting taxes, you're going to have a reduction in government revenues. That's the whole purpose of cutting taxes. But they did not make the adjustment and they did not cut spending. Case in point, 2012, the year that they cut taxes by $4.5 billion, that same year they increased spending by over $430 million, which represented a 7% increase in spending. Now, that's a recipe for disaster that precipitated and led to what ultimately were repeated budget shortfalls. Now, so they did not keep spending in check. Let's contrast that with North Carolina, which had the landmark just 1 year after Kansas' tax cuts. North Carolina enacted the landmark 2013 tax reform, significantly reducing personal and corporate tax rates, which before then had been the highest in the Southeast. So they brought those rates down, brought the top rate from 7.75% down to now where it is today, below 5.5% and going down further based on recent actions. And they took the corporate rate as well from 6.9 down to 3.3% where it is today, and it's set to go further down to 2.5% in 2019. But where North Carolina contrasts with Kansas is North Carolina kept spending in check. They budgeted conservatively. Unlike Kansas, after North Carolina cut taxes, they kept the growth in spending below the rate of growth in population inflation. And so what have we seen in North Carolina? At the same time that they've returned billions of dollars to taxpayers, to employers, to families across the state, at the same time they've done that, the state has experienced perennial budget surpluses, which have allowed them to enact subsequent rounds of tax relief, including this most recent budget just a few weeks ago. Not only does the state have surpluses, it's allowed the state to build the largest rainy day fund in state history and has a AAA credit rating. So North Carolina shows what a model for successful pro-growth tax reform and spending restraint looks like. And that's where Kansas missed the mark. They cut taxes, they failed to rein in spending, and as a result, they came back and actually ended up raising taxes.
We are chatting with Patrick Gleason. He is the Director of State Affairs at Americans for Tax Reform. And obviously, you're talking about a contrast here between Kansas and North Carolina. If other states are looking at the potential of tax reform, they ought to be looking at the way that North Carolina does it, shouldn't they? And not only looking at the tax side, but also that spending side.
Yeah, and so North Carolina is really a national model for what smart, conservative, responsible, pro-growth tax relief looks like. As I mentioned, while they were cutting rates, they were cutting some of the most economically damaging taxes, personal income tax, which also hits small businesses, the corporate rate, also getting rid of the death tax. But it is important, and this is what Kansas did not do. They kept spending in check. And I would say, you know, the obsession with Kansas we see in the media, and also it's gotten up to the national level where we were having a federal tax reform debate in Washington, D.C. right now, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and national Democrats are referencing Kansas and saying, oh, this is a cautionary tale, why we can't cut taxes. Well, it's a diversionary tactic. And frankly, the obsession with Kansas and the misdirection by wanting to focus on Kansas shows what a weak hand Democrats and the left has to play on fiscal policy, because they have to hold up this one small state which made a number of mistakes and was in no ways a model for conservative tax and spending reform. They have to hold that state up because a broader sampling of all 50 states actually debunks what they're trying to claim and shows that all other things being equal, lower rates of taxation lead to higher rates of economic growth, population growth, and income growth. So the obsession with Kansas shows what a weak hand they have to play. There's North Carolina, which is a counterexample that shows what to do and the good that can come out of that. There's also other counterexamples, Texas, Florida. Our neighbors to the west of here in Tennessee have been cutting taxes repeatedly in recent years, like North Carolina, have had repeated budget surpluses. So there's a number of case studies that counter Kansas and rebut it. But then there's also the aggregate social science. And John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood has done a great job compiling all the academic research on fiscal policy and finding that by and large, most of the studies find that lower rates of taxation and spending are more conducive with economic growth and prosperity.
Now, the Democrats obviously have been focusing on Kansas, but as part of your job, you talk to people who are dealing with tax issues at the state level across the country. Are other states who are looking at tax reform, do they get it? Do they see that, hey, if we do it the way North Carolina does, we're going to be in better shape?
Yeah. So I spend my time and working in state capitals around the country in my role as the head of Americans for Tax Reform State Department. And what's interesting is there's a number of states looking at doing tax reform. They want to do rate reducing tax reform because we're at this time of great competition between the states. And states need to make their fiscal policies and tax codes as conducive to economic growth and competitive as possible. So as a number of states are looking at tax reform both later this year and into 2018, and as we saw earlier this year, states that were looking at that, the side that wanted to oppose tax cuts, they all kept talking about Kansas. Well, luckily, North Carolina and the example that they set was there, because if that were not the case, that Kansas cautionary scare tactic might have worked. But we were able to highlight North Carolina and say, no, Here's an example of a state that did it right. So the rate-reducing tax reform that North Carolina has enacted has been great for the state in its own right, you know, for economic growth in the state, for job creation, for attracting investment, new residents. But it's also had a national effect. So as other states that are looking to do rate-reducing tax reform and also at the federal level in Congress have looked to and been discussing what North Carolina has done, and when the other side tries to scare folks in other states from reducing tax rates by pointing to Kansas, we're able to point to North Carolina and say, no, there's a way to do it right. North Carolina has done it, and you should look to what they've done. So the Tar Heel State has really been a national leader in tax reform.
One of the people who's going to be watching these issues very closely as states and the federal government continue to focus on tax reform issues is Patrick Gleason. He is Director of State Affairs at Americans for Tax Reform. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal. We hold government accountable to you.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The newest member of North Carolina's congressional delegation is taking on some high-profile issues in his first term. Republican Ted Budd represents the 13th District. He recently discussed a proposal to end something called the Davis-Bacon Act.
The Davis-Bacon Act hinders economic growth and increases the federal deficit. It imposes enormous burdens and stifles contractor productivity, ignores skill differences for different jobs, and imposes rigid craft work rules. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the Davis-Bacon Act will raise federal construction costs by $13 billion between 2015 and 2023. Now, wages are often set at or above the union scale, despite the fact that only 13% of the private construction workforce is even unionized nationwide, Mr. Chairman. The Davis-Bacon wage determinations have also been known to be lower than the current market rate, which is equally problematic and especially detrimental for local contractors. It's just erratic. Now, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has repeatedly criticized DOL's Davis-Bacon wage determination process for its lack of transparency in how the published wage rates and its tendency to gather erroneous data through unscientific wage surveys. Now, repealing the DBA would allow the government to build more infrastructure and create 155,000 new construction-related jobs at the very same cost to the taxpayers. In fact, repealing the Davis-Bacon would have saved the federal government $10.9 billion, and that was back in 2011. This amendment would uphold the government's responsibility to deliver quality infrastructure improvements at the best possible price to the taxpayers, which is certainly what we owe them.
In another recent speech on Capitol Hill, Congressman Ted Budd supported a bill to set a new national strategy for fighting terrorism and illicit finance.
The financing of terrorism and related forms of illicit finance present a direct threat to our national security and financial system. So it is critical for the government to create and maintain a unified strategy to fight financial crime, both to accommodate new and developing threats and to help Congress develop legislative and funding priorities now and in the future. Additionally, a national strategy should seek to enhance intergovernmental cooperation and to identify illicit financing trends and to encourage federal agencies to work with the private financial sector to do the same. This bill does these things and will go a long way in making sure we are keeping pace with the ever-changing terror finance landscape.
That's first-year North Carolina Congressman Ted Budd, Republican representing the 13th District. He's tackling some high-profile issues during his first term on Capitol Hill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A North Carolinian leads one of the most high-profile conservative groups on Capitol Hill, the U.S. House Freedom Caucus. Representative Mark Meadows of the 11th District recently described the caucus's work during a speech at the National Press Club. First, Meadows set the record straight about the group's origins.
I had one Democrat colleague the other day who was saying, well, for 6 years you have been out there trying to make sure that things don't get done in Washington, D.C. I said, well, that's real interesting because actually we created it a little over 2 years ago. I got on the phone after a very frustrating time where we had some of the conservative members voting one way, more conservative members voting another way. I got on the phone with Jim Jordan and I said, we've got to actually be organized. If we're going to carry forward a message for the millions of American people who think that Washington, D.C. has forgotten them, we need to be organized.
Meadows also addressed the notion that House Freedom Caucus members hold identical views on all topics.
Many of them think that we're exactly alike. And yet it's some of the best debate that you'll find on Capitol Hill because as we come together, the three dozen plus members, we come together and we actually have debate on some of the policies that we should be having debates on the floor of the House each and every day. And yet what we found is so many times there are speeches that get made on the floor of the House, but there's not a whole lot of debate. There's not a whole lot of going back and forth. And so as you look at some of our members, they are very different. We have libertarians and what you would say traditional conservatives. We have some who are more aligned with leadership and some who would never vote for leadership. And yet, here we are. I believed that we needed to take a business approach to what we do as conservatives. And so, as we embarked on setting things up, we actually, the Freedom Caucus has a set of bylaws. People don't realize that as we came together, we said we need a structure, some rules, so we actually have a set of bylaws, and that structure actually provides for a good foundation to make sure that we're member-driven. One of the complaints we have is that it's not right that just a few members of Congress would be super members of Congress and get to decide everything that happens on Capitol Hill. We believe that it needs to be a bottom-up approach, and the same goes for the Freedom Caucus. And so as we looked at that, we said that everybody who brings an idea there gets to take that idea.
That's U.S. Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina's Western 11th District. He chairs the conservative House Freedom Caucus. Meadows says the caucus has been looking for ways to apply congressional rules to boost conservative causes.
The Holman Rule actually was non-existent since 1983. We put it back in as a way to cut down on some of the federal bureaucracy because it gives us the tool to actually go in and cut the funding without cutting an entire agency. Now, you can tell that a number of us have been very critical of the Congressional Budget Office. In fact, I think they're the one group that makes a weatherman's 10-day forecast look accurate. And so as we see that, we believe that we needed to address it. So this amendment will actually go in using the Holman Rule that says that we're going to reduce their employees by 89, some $15 million, not a big targeted selection. But in doing that, what we said is they ought to be aggregators. There's plenty of think tanks that are out there. And so we ought to take a score from Heritage, from AEI, from Brookings, from the Urban Institute, and bring them together for a composite score that would represent a very wide swath of actually think tanks and their abilities. And so we think that that's a pragmatic way to use the private sector and let yet Congress depend on a score that's accurate.
Meadows addressed another myth about the House Freedom Caucus.
The other thing that is a misnomer is that we all vote in lockstep together. Now, we have in part of our bylaws that if we get to an 80% threshold, we will take a position. Now, I say that because getting 36 people to agree on anything is almost impossible. Getting to 80% is extremely difficult. But we have made the decision that if we get to 80%, we will take an official position, which means that we will all vote together with one exception. You get two passes a year, I mean, two passes of Congress to vote. So let's say you had something that was very critical to your district. And as we've taken that position, and you, let's take the Export-Import Bank, and you said, well, I've got Boeing in my district. I need to be supporting them. You would be able to get a pass up to twice during a congressional calendar and not be kicked out of the group. But outside of that, you're going to have to actually vote with the group. Now, what the power of this is it gives us the power of negation. Now, when I say that, is when you can stop things from happening, it gives you great power on what things might happen. So it's the power of no. But it's just as critical for us to have the power of yes.
Meadows offered some examples of stances the House Freedom Caucus has taken. One involved the federal debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling is coming. It is time that we get it done. It is like a florist being surprised by Valentine's Day. We know it's coming. Let's go ahead and deal with it, and let's make sure that we do that. And so as we start to look at that, you will find the Freedom Caucus is pushing more and more and more to make critical decisions, even if they're decisions that we don't like. So there is structure, but there's also great flexibility.
Meadows offered another example from this summer.
When we called for us to cancel the recess, where we said if there's no results, there should be no recess, That happened one particular night at a meeting where we were there, that all of a sudden we were having this meeting and the notice came that we were canceling our Friday votes. Well, we couldn't figure out why we were canceling our Friday votes since we had plenty to do. And so the comment was made, you know, we shouldn't be canceling Friday votes. In fact, if anything, we should be staying here in August. So from one comment that was started by a member within the caucus, we took an official position that particular night and actually said, let's stay in August. You know what? I bet more than 80% of Americans agree that we should stay in August and get things done. And when you look at that, that's what we're all about, is giving that forgotten man or that forgotten woman a voice on Capitol Hill.
Congressman Mark Meadows shared thoughts about the House Freedom Caucus's communications strategy.
We decided to go on a communication strategy to take our message to where our power really comes from. And our power comes from the people themselves who think that Washington, D.C. has forgotten them. And they're just begging for someone to stand up on their behalf. They're begging for people to say, I'm tired of the political correctness, just get something done. We have embarked and tried to say that on any given situation, we will offer two solutions. Because we've been accused of saying it's our way or the highway. And so whether it's with the debt ceiling or whether it's with the budget or anything else, we are trying to make sure that we give at least two alternatives for a solution. So when you hear that it is our way or the highway, know that today you heard this, and I would challenge you. The reporters here in the room, ask us, what are your two ways to solve this particular situation? And if we can't articulate that, I would let you remind me of this conversation. We'll make sure that we have two results.
That's U.S. Representative Mark Meadows, a Republican from North Carolina's 11th District. He's chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, one of the most conservative groups on Capitol Hill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Ensuring that all North Carolina kids get the education that best meets their needs. That's the goal for many policymakers, advocates, and think tanks as well. It's how we get there that really creates the interesting discussion and sometimes debate. New data released by the state's Department of Public Instruction could help inform this discussion about where the needs and where the demands really are. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's interesting that we know, of course, North Carolina is growing in population. Is the school age population also growing? And are we seeing that in the enrollment numbers?
Well, we're seeing it, but in an unconventional way. The district school enrollment actually dropped over the last year. And this was something that hasn't happened for several decades. And the one factor that stands out for this producing this sort of drop is the charter school enrollment.
So when you say district school, help us understand what you mean.
I mean the 115 school districts in North Carolina that are the conventional, what may be called traditional public schools. And these are the places where most people equate public schools.
But we also now have this growing number of public charter schools. So it sounds like we may have a shift of students from those traditional schools to the charter schools in such numbers that now we're really seeing the differential.
That's right. We're going to have about 173 public charter schools in the upcoming school year. And what we saw a year-over-year change is that there was a shift of about 9,800 students that entered the charter school sector. So while we had a loss of the number of students that were in the district school sector, we saw an increase in the number of charter school students. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the upcoming year we'll see over 100,000 students educated in public charter schools.
Let's talk about some of the regional trends. Where are we seeing the largest decreases in the traditional enrollment, and where are we seeing the gains?
Well, we're seeing decreases mainly in the rural areas. And for those who live in places like Charlotte-Mecklenburg or in Wake County or in Raleigh, we're so used to having large increases in students that we might forget that in many areas of the state, they're losing significant numbers of students. And this is especially true in the northeastern part of the state that's lost anywhere between 10 and 25% of their student population. So, you know, if you look around the state and over the last 5 years, basically, enrollment has been stagnant in North Carolina as far as the district schools are concerned. I think I calculated that there was only about 70,000 student increase in a total population being around 1.4 million students. So very minor increase in students considering the size of the district systems.
In some of those counties in the more rural areas where they're losing the student numbers, one might think, well, perhaps it's because of charter school enrollment in those areas, but also could it just be just general population decrease as people are moving out of those areas and moving to more urban centers for jobs primarily?
Yeah, it's a pretty complicated picture because charter schools are moving into those areas where in the past they have not been. So we're seeing an increase in charter schools in the northeastern part of the state and some of our rural communities. But because the manufacturing industries have left those areas, we're seeing a population decline, just don't have the jobs that they used to have. And so people are going to where the jobs are, which are mainly in our urban and suburban counties and a few other areas in the state.
Terry, one of the things that you do and do so well here at the John Locke Foundation is to analyze the data and the trends. And when the data changes, then the potential for policy changes takes place. And you've been looking at those questions based on the newest enrollment data. So what does this mean to us? What trends might we see that we perhaps wouldn't have predicted 5-10 years ago?
Well, parents now have a number of options that they never had in the past, and they are taking advantage of those options. Homeschooling has become easier. They're allowed to have more cooperative experiences with other families. Private schools, we now have vouchers that allow low-income and special needs students to enter a private school with some state assistance. And charter schools have increased significantly, the number of charter schools and the enrollment allowances for existing charter schools are allowing parents to finally vote with their feet, whereas in the past, they didn't really have options unless they were wealthy and they could pay for the private school tuition, or wealthy in the sense that they can forego a parent's financial contribution to educate the child at home.
You mentioned earlier about Wake County and Mecklenburg County and folks who live in those areas of the state. You know, it's kind of, they may be scratching their head saying, what, you know, fewer people, fewer kids enrolled in school? All we hear about is growth. Those are two monster school districts in Charlotte and Wake County. Could there be maybe some folks who are now starting to say, you know what, they're perhaps too big?
Yeah, the General Assembly is going to look at this issue, and they have a task force set up that's going to examine and ask that question of are these districts too big, and are there ways to break them up that might be beneficial to students? Because that's really that really needs to be the focus here. Is a district approaching 150,000 students really good for the students in that district or the teachers that teach in it? And so they are going to consider whether there are ways that we could break up those districts, or whether there are ways that we can go about approaching the problem that would make it easier for parents, make it easier for kids to have a more responsive school district and one that really truly meets their needs?
What about on the other end of the spectrum? We now have a handful of school districts that are quite small. Any way that we could somehow perhaps get those districts to work together? Are there really any benefits that would come to the parents, the kids, the teachers?
I think so. We're seeing some shrinking school districts, some hovering around 1,000 students. And I think it's important to note that I would never advocate for the state to force them to merge. I think there's a movement afoot that some people want to force some of the smaller school districts to merge, or some of the city school districts to merge with their counties. I don't know that that's the solution. I would like to see the school districts themselves come up with a solution and perhaps look at ways of sharing resources, or perhaps even consolidating those districts. I know that's tough because there's a lot of pride that these communities have in their schools. But we have to realize, too, that we need to benefit the students. And a school district that's small can't provide the types of courses that a larger school district can or services that a larger school district can. So it might be good for these districts to start at least exploring the idea of merging.
Terry, we've mentioned charter schools. I wanted to, in our remaining moment with you, talk about the issue of homeschooling, because that has grown astronomically over the past few years. Why?
Well, it's become easier. There are numerous websites that will help any homeschool parent, plus the cooperative arrangements that many homeschools have are certainly a way for homeschoolers to make it much easier for them. We have around 127,000 kids in homeschools. It continues to increase every year. And I think that because the state has made it easier to homeschool and the internet, we'll continue to see that rise.
Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program. Thanks for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.